Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense.
Welcome to the On Point Podcast. This is your host, Luke Elshoff, a first year hailing from Region 8 based in NCFCA. This is a weekly podcast where I'll have a guest on the show and cover something in speech or debate. I hope you enjoy this episode. And now a word from our sponsor. Since its founding in 2011, Ziggy Online Debate has hosted over 2,000 registrations and facilitated nearly 3 million in scholarships from its sponsors. Ziggy offers online seasonal tournaments for preseason prep in the fall and mid-season prep in the spring. These opportunities give you unrivaled access to face out-of-region competition, cases, and arguments with qualified judges all season long. In just under 3 weeks, Ziggy is hosting their first ever live-paced national championship, which will consist of full preliminary rounds and out rounds. Sign up now by going to ziggyonlinedebate.com and receive early bird pricing. You can also use code ONPOINT to receive 10% off your registration. Among notable sponsors, Howard Payne University is giving away $60,000 scholarships for all winners and runner-ups, and $56,000 scholarships for all third and fourth place teams. Whether you need a head start into your nationals campaign or desire more debating opportunities, the Ziggy National Championship is just for you. Hello and welcome back to another episode. Today I'm joined by Ben Brown, an alumnus of NCFCA, who has an impressive debate portfolio. In 2019, he ranked 12th at nationals for team policy. In 2021, he got first place at two tournaments and fifth place at nationals. And in 2022, his final year, he won three tournaments, including winning nationals for team policy debate. Outside of debate, he won five tournaments in impromptu, four in extemp, and ranked fourth for after dinner speaking at nationals. I'm so glad that you could join me today, Ben.
For sure. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on, Luke.
Of course. So you're an alumni right now, right?
That's correct.
All right, so what are you doing now? Are you studying anything? What college are you going to?
Yes, so I just finished up my freshman year at Hillsdale College, where I'm studying economics and applied mathematics. That could change in the next year or two, but that's somewhat unlikely. The craziest change I'd probably make is switching from applied math to pure math, so nothing out there.
Right. So would you say that speech and debate, or NCFCA in general, has that influenced your life outside of high school?
By outside of high school, do you mean beyond academics, beyond age 18, or is there anything specific you're getting at there?
After graduation.
Oh, absolutely. I think in particular, the ability, it's cliche, but the ability to think critically, to form an argument clearly and quickly, I mean, it's got plenty of applications outside of debate, writing papers chiefly in my current situation, of course, though that's not to say that's the only application, of course, just what I'm looking at right now. But no, the value of speech and debate, and I think debate in particular, cannot be undersold, and I'm so glad to have been able to do it during high school.
Right. And how long have you been doing speech and debate for when you did do it?
So I did debate for 5 years and speech for four.
And throughout those years, I assume that you didn't start at the level of being a champion of team policy at nationals. So you definitely have progressed throughout those years and have gotten significantly better throughout your experience in debate.
Yeah, for sure. My first two tournaments in TP, you know, I went 1-5. My speaks average was pretty abysmal. And I haven't gone 1-5 since my first year. So I would say I've improved at least somewhat, if that's an indicator of anything.
Right. So has anything transformative happened in your experience that has developed your speaking style or just developed yourself as a speaker?
So when you say speaking or speaking style, you mean like the way that I present as opposed to how I think or argue. Am I understanding you correctly?
Just either way, anything in general that has happened.
Okay. I guess I'll talk about my speaking style and then my debating, as it were, separately. Speaking style, you know, I just did what worked for the first few years. You know, I tried to follow all the conventional advice, avoid fillers, try to be organized, have a distinct roadmap, etc., the usual stuff. I did reasonably well, though I wasn't picking up, you know, any top five speaker awards at tournaments or anything like that. Then one tournament my junior year, I decided I was going to just try a more laid back speaking style. Like I remember during an online tournament, it was the first tournament I was experimenting with this style. My partner messaged me in the middle of the round and asked me if I needed like coffee or something like that. So yeah, maybe it was a bit excessive, but that tournament, I got first place speaks, and I never gotten the speaker award anywhere near that before. So I rang with that for the rest of the year. And then my senior year, I focused less on, I guess, speaking well, and I prioritized communicating the ideas that I wanted to get across. Because, you know, let's say, for example, you want to make some point very emphatically, persuasively, passionately, as it were. And so you have this long, elaborate intro that's going to link into this fantastic argument you're going to make, and it's going to be wrapped up with a fantastic conclusion. That can be very persuasive, and I very much admire people that are able to speak well in that capacity. But at least with the skill sets that I've developed over the last 5 years, I find that there are trade-offs involved in that speaking style. Whether those trade-offs are worth it depends on the person. But, you know, for example, it takes more time to give an elaborate 30 seconds to 1 minute intro. It takes time to have that fantastic, passionate, smashing conclusion. And so you're not able to argue as effectively. And so I focused less on those rhetorical flourishes and more on just getting my ideas across. And I'd say my speaks probably went down slightly from junior year to senior year. I haven't like tried to calculate or anything, maybe by a quarter point or so on average, but nothing crazy. So that's, I guess, if my speaking style has quote unquote undergone transformation, I mean, I'd say those are the three sorts of speaking styles that I've run with for any considerable period of time. Then debating, let's see. So, like I said, I started debating in my eighth grade year. I did not do so of my own volition. My mom forced me to join debates. I absolutely hated it for probably a good 6 months. There were, you know, many tears shed over long hours spent on homework assignments club gave me that I did not want to do in the least. About 6 months in, though, I started to enjoy it. It was almost like a light switch went off or something. I don't really know how to explain it. I know other people have similar experiences with, you know, being forced in by parents, then eventually enjoying the activity. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, that was the first transformation, enjoying it, of course. And so I got really into debates, you know, after my eighth grade year. During freshman and sophomore years, you know, I'd probably spend 20 plus hours a week between, you know, research, practice rounds, etc. I remember in particular my sophomore year, well, at least before the season got canceled because of COVID, my partner and I would get up at 5:45, 3 days a week, you know, to hop on the Zoom call and do research together. So, I mean, I was pretty into it. And that was more or less my debate style during freshman and sophomore year. Just, you know, research a lot, have a lot of evidence in your box, try to be prepared to debate against as many cases as possible. Try not to be caught without evidence against any cases, have a well-developed AF case, etc. I mean, I think I went through and counted at one point or something before Nationals my freshman year. We had something like 90-some-odd briefs in the box, over 1,000 pages of evidence. Our AF case was pushing three digits. You get the idea. Sophomore year, very similar. I'm not saying that's a bad way to research since, you know, I changed it or changed my approach eventually, you know. We all know people who use that approach to TP, use it successfully, and I, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But my approach changed between sophomore and junior year. So, you know, COVID hits, nobody has anything to do. And so some friends of mine and I just did a load, but like a lots of TP and parley rounds for practice. I'd say during the first couple of months of quarantine, say, I don't know, mid-March through mid-May, we were probably doing anywhere between 5 and 15 practice rounds a week, depending on the given week. And so, like I said, a lot of that was parley. And so I just got lots of practice with, you know, being forced to develop arguments quickly. It's very much analogous to going neg without a brief, especially when you have a policy resolution. I remember the first parley round I did not go that well. Like, I was just sort of cringing, dying in my seat in front of my computer at the end of the round. But, you know, those 2 months, I probably improved more during them as a debater than I did any other period of 2 months or even a year during my debate career. And so because of that extensive practice with parley during COVID, my approach to TP changed to being much more comparable to how one might typically approach parley. So, you know, I didn't use that much evidence. My AF cases were significantly shorter. I would knowingly, you know, choose not to prepare neg briefs against cases, because I found that, you know, having evidence in front of me, you know, sometimes you tunnel in on the arguments that the evidence suggests to you, and you don't think about, you know, other arguments that could be made from a purely logical standpoint that you don't need evidence for. And, you know, that's not to say that I'm somehow better than other people because I don't need evidence. I don't think that's at all the case. I'm certainly a worse researcher than other debaters I know, since I didn't invest as much time in research my junior and senior years. But that approach was enjoyable at the very least, because it's less mechanical when you're in round. Because, you know, say you have a 20-page brief against a case walking in, you know, you're like, okay, I'm going to run these 3 or 4 arguments in the 1NC, these arguments in the 2NC. It's going to be great. We're going to see what happens. Hope the ship isn't sunk by the end. Maybe we'll even win. Whereas if you don't have your arguments planned going in, A, it's more organic. Like, you're forced to think in every single, well, let me backtrack. You have to think in every round no matter what. But you have to generate arguments in more rounds than you don't when you choose not to prepare evidence, which is enjoyable, if not occasionally stressful. And so, yeah, that was the approach I used for the last 2 years of high school. Last year that we just finished up, 2022, my AF backup was only 8 pages long going into nationals. I just preferred to, you know, operate without evidence where possible. So I guess, does that answer your question about transformation as a speaker? I know I went off on a bit of a tangent there. I want to make sure I didn't miss anything.
No, you're totally fine. I think that absolutely nailed the question. And I'm glad you kind of gave that kind of background information on what you said. And something that particularly stood out to me was how you mentioned that you did parley and that really helped your argumentative skills. And you brought up how in team policy, you started using evidence less and less, and you actually started listening to what the opponent was saying and started not to rely on your evidence and the perspective that the evidence wants to show, as in like the arguments that the evidence has. But rather thinking critically of the evidence that your opponents are presenting. So you mentioned that that you started listening more critically to what they were saying. Would you say that that's a more useful skill than actually having a lot of evidence?
I don't think it's the skill that I suggest as an alternative to evidence, or at least as something that would diminish one's need for evidence, isn't so much one's ability to listen critically to what the opponent is saying, because to critically understand what your opponent is saying is just to really internalize what they're arguing, and that's good, and it's essential even. But it's completely possible to have a perfect grasp of what your opponent is saying and still have no idea what to argue. Case in point, I think a lot of people run into this issue when they're neg against another team that's running their same AF case. You know, some people say, oh boy, I got to go neg against my own AF case. I know all the arguments. We're going to crush this round. And I wish I had that mindset, but I don't. Because, like, you know, I like to think my AF case is bulletproof. It's certainly not, but, you know, it's entertaining to gaslight oneself into that perspective, helpfully even when you're affirmative. Not so much when you're negative, because, you know all the arguments against your AF case, and hopefully you know good responses to all of the arguments against your AF case. And so when you're sitting there listening to the affirmative deliver what is effectively your own 1AC, you often can sometimes feel paralyzed because you're like, okay, maybe I'll run this argument. Oh, wait, no, there's this great response to it. They probably know about it. Okay, what if I run this argument? Oh, wait, no, they'll be able to respond to that too. Perfect example right there of, you know, critically understanding what your opponents are saying. You definitely know your own AF case. You know the arguments they're making. But that doesn't necessarily translate into ease of refutation. And so I think more broadly, the skill that parley helps you develop, I say parley, really just practice rounds generally, but parley especially, is argument generation. So the ability to take what an opponent is saying and have an intuition for A, what sorts of arguments are available to you, and B, which of those arguments would be effective in defeating the case they're reading.
Right. So, yeah, I think you made a really good summation of, well, what I was saying, but also why it's important to have both skills. So with the topic at hand that we're going to discuss today, I really wanted to focus a bit more on impromptu negatives, but just in general, just debate and TP as a whole. But this idea of impromptu negatives, it's something that's inevitable. You'll always run into some sort of case at one point in another that you don't really have specific evidence towards. So tell me what you would do in that instance when you would hit a case that you don't necessarily have a dedicated brief towards.
Yes. So I think broadly speaking, as though this generally encompasses all possible approaches. There are two possible approaches that at least I'll talk about that, you know, can work. The first is, you know, probably more for the people who favor that style of spending, you know, 20 hours a week on research, having long briefs, etc., is, you know, to develop general arguments of sorts. So, you know, general disadvantages where you have your internal links and impacts prepared beforehand. And in those situations, all you have to figure out is, or conceive of, is how the AF plan might link into that disadvantage or trigger the first domino that you do have evidence on. So, like, let's say, oh, I didn't know. You have some piece of evidence saying that if China gets mad at the US, they're going to do X. They're going to impose some crazy trade restriction, and that would be bad. It's going to lead to all of these impacts that I have loads of evidence on. You've never heard the AF case before, but you do have this evidence talking about what happens if China gets mad. And so you just have to think logically of how the AF plan fits into the link and pushes that first domino. That approach is effective because A, it means that you're never truly neg without a brief. You're always going to have disadvantages that are perhaps at least plausibly linked to the affirmative case. You only have to think of what that link is rather than thinking of an entire, you know, argument or disadvantage. You don't have to think about the impacts and the internal links. You've already got that beforehand. It's also particularly effective because you come across as more prepared necessarily if you have more evidence. I'll admit that that's one shortcoming that my approach to TP in my light years of high school had. You know, judges would often criticize me for having relatively little evidence in my speeches, and they were right. I think I looked back at my flows between sophomore and junior year. I mark on my flows each argument that I use evidence for. And like the average number of cards I'd use in a 1NC, for example, dropped from 6 cards to I think 1.9 or something like that. And so that's why having general arguments, or I say general arguments, typically general disadvantages, since links are easier to come up with for them rather than on-case arguments just by their nature, are to be preferred. The other approach, I don't know if you'd really call it an approach, is, how do I put this? If you're coming up with, if you don't have general disadvantages in your deck without a brief, and you're sitting there coming up with arguments at the table, I think it's generally more of a subconscious process, by which I mean it's pretty rare for, you know, someone to be sitting there listening to Af read a case, and they're like, okay, let's see, I want to come up with an argument about this. Okay, here's premise one. Okay, I just thought of premise two. Excellent. Okay, here we go. Premise three. Conclusion, you should vote neg. It's not conscious. It's not like you're building something. You know, typically you're sitting there and like an argument hits you out of nowhere like a bolt of lightning, as it were. And, you know, you run that argument. You don't know where you don't know where it came from. You didn't think of it, per se. All you know is that it works. And so you run it. The tricky thing with that is, by its nature, there's nothing explicably dependable about that process. And at that point, it's merely a question of pattern recognition, subconscious processing, etc., which you can't control. And so I say it's a second approach to impromptu negative. It's only an approach insofar as you're doing something before the round to prepare for impromptu negative. Specifically, you know, you're doing those practice rounds with Parley. You're practicing argument generation over and over again. You're hearing loads of different AF cases across all sorts of resolutions. I think eventually, you know, your brain starts to form connections between different types of cases, arguments, etc. You don't even know those connections are there until they manifest in that TP round where you don't have a brief, but there's something similar about the AF case to something you've done before that you can't pinpoint, except that you know the similarity exists, hence your ability to present an argument. So you aren't doing anything. Well, I say you aren't doing anything. There's certainly something to be said for, you know, consciously thinking, okay, what can we do about the AF team's case that we don't have a brief on? You can certainly do things like, you know, run through the stock issues in your head as a checklist, think about each of them for 15, 20 seconds. You can certainly do things like read their plan text three times to see if there's anything in there that might be problematic for them. That certainly can get you great arguments. It often does. But the heavy lifting of the, I guess, less evidence-heavy approach is in those practice rounds, I think.
Right. So to kind of like summarize your second approach, that's basically pattern processing, which is done subconsciously through lots of effort and practice rounds. And eventually you develop a sort of style that you can generate these arguments in your head. So basically it's like the work of the practice that you put in. Is that what you're saying?
Essentially, yes.
Right. So basically you're not actually doing anything in the round to prepare against a case that you don't have anything on. You're just using these arguments that you have become skilled with and generating, and using this skill against their case that you don't have any real experience with, right?
I wouldn't say you're quote-unquote not doing anything. Because there are some conscious things you can do, like I talked about. You can have a stock issues checklist, you can read the plan text, you can nitpick evidence, I don't know, et cetera. So you are doing something. And, you know, B, those thoughts come to you, you have an argument, you still have to figure out how to get that thought from your brain to your flow to the judge. So it's not that you're not doing anything, it's just that what you are doing is considerably different from what you might call a typical impromptu negative approach.
I see. That makes a lot more sense. So with impromptu negatives, in the prep time, is there anything that you should do actively in the prep time, or what would you do in prep time as you're facing an impromptu neg? As you're using an impromptu neg against a case you haven't hit before or don't have experience or a brief on?
Before answering what to do, say during 1NC prep, the first question is what to do in cross-sex as the 1N. I think when you're impromptu neg, it's particularly important to listen to your partner cross-sexing the 1A. There are all sorts of reasons why that's important. But the big one with impromptu neg is that you get information you didn't know was out there before. Because, if you've got a 20-page brief on a case, your partner is cross-sexing the 1A, the 1A is probably not going to say something that you didn't know about the case. You've already put in, the hours researching it. A lot of what the AF does. And so you're less likely to be surprised with new information. When you're impromptu neg, you want to listen to that cross-ex very closely because you can get information out of it. And that information might at first glance be neutral. That information, A, can serve as a premise in some arguments that you might be forming. And B, and more importantly, it can potentially suggest arguments. It could, trigger something that you hadn't even thought about before. And, there's your solvency arguments or something like that. What to do during prep time? First of all, I pay attention to the specific text of the AF team's plan, read it a couple of times. That's probably the most important part of any 1AC. And second, I'd ask your partner if they have any ideas for arguments. Because, typically, I think especially during impromptu neg rounds, you're going to be less organized because you didn't plan what you were going to do beforehand in the strictest sense of the word. And so you and your partner aren't necessarily on the same page. And so talking with your partner gets you on the same page. But more importantly, you have to say something when you get it for the 1NC. You got to have A arguments at the very least. Your partner could have a very different perspective on the round that, you hadn't even considered prior to talking to them. Like they might have some argument you hadn't thought of before. I think those are the only two general prescriptions that I would suggest reading the plan text and talking to your partner. Else, it's very much case-by-case basis.
Yes. So would you say, picking apart a case, is there, a general strategy that you can use, especially if you're impromptu neg, to pick apart a case, or is that also something that's very dependent upon a case-by-case basis? Of course, generally speaking, it is a very case-by-case basis, but what would you say is something that you should look for when trying to pick apart a case?
What do you mean pick apart a case?
Identify weak spots.
And we're talking about what you do in prep time?
In prep time, yes.
I don't think there's anything I'd add to what I've already said. The question, what should you do when you're impromptu neg and how should you pick apart a case, are more or less analogous, since in both instances, you're trying to identify issues with some argument in support of the resolution that you're confronted with.
Yeah, so that makes sense. But with impromptu neg, since you say that you're a little less on the research-heavy side, would you say that there's, at least in some way, some sort of advantage to going impromptu neg?
So a few. One, your delivery is going to be more persuasive, at least insofar as the ideas you communicate are more likely to hit with the judge. By which I mean, Say you prepare that 20-page neg brief 2 months in advance of a tournament, you're well prepared to debate against it. When you pick up that neg brief to debate that case, you know, it's essentially 2 months ago version, the 2 months ago version of you talking to the present day version of you. You might not understand as well as you did 2 months ago what you're trying to say with a particular argument, especially if you know you got a lot of evidence, subpoints, organization difficulties, what have you. Whereas if you're impromptu neg, in general, all of the arguments you're coming up with are necessarily conceived in the moment, and so you understand the arguments better that you do make. Second, I think there's a time allocation advantage, because you know, reading evidence can take a lot of time, especially, you know, if you have to read a bunch of credentials, read a full quotation, 3 or 4 sentences, etc. Whereas if you're impromptu neg, you don't have that problem, and so you're less concerned with cramming everything in, as it were. And one thing I will add, the approach that I took to TP is not to be impromptu negative, although of course that does happen sometimes if you don't research as much. The approach I take is to walk in with less or no research. The difference being that you can prepare to debate cases outside the means of research in practice rounds. So, you know, last year, for example, with the prison policy resolution, I was, you know, reasonably confident in my ability to beat most cases by the end of the year, either because, you know, I had some research on them in the case, in the instances where, you know, I, you know, collected evidence beforehand, or I thought it through, I thought there were obvious problems with the case. Not to say that those problems, you know, are obvious or necessarily are problems. The entire point of the debate is to, you know, assess whether or not neg's evaluation of exposition is correct. But the few cases, there were 3 cases that I was concerned about. It was acquitted conduct sentencing, PLRA, and then the crack cocaine case. The details of those cases are unimportant. The issue being that I wasn't as confident in my ability to beat those cases as I was other cases. And so my method of preparation was less dependent on research and more I just, you know, sit there and mull over the case in my head, what I knew about it. So, like, you know, I remember my family went on a road trip to Colorado right before a big national open. And so, you know, a lot of that time in the car, I just, you know, spent there staring out the window, thinking about those cases. Because I think even more valuable than Google in the preparation process is one's own mind / cognitive ability to form arguments. Because Google cannot give you arguments at the end of the day. Your mind can. And more importantly, Google is only going to suggest evidence-based arguments. Or that's not true. I suppose Google, excuse me, might make an argument that you don't need evidence for, but there's no guarantee that every possible argument exists on Google. And so it's not that I didn't prepare, it's that I prepared by thinking about cases more than I did researching them. I think that's an important distinction to draw.
Right. And I think that's a very important thing that a lot of people might need to realize going into team policy. Since my own perception of it was very evidence-based and I needed to spend more time, I realize now, thinking about these arguments and thinking about these cases critically as you do and identifying the weak spots and not just looking for evidence online, since that is such a crucial part of actual team policy. So you mentioned in like impromptu negs, so of course it wouldn't be something that you would want to go out of your way to do. Impromptu negs isn't something ideal, but if it does come, there are ways that you can use them to your advantage, correct?
Definitely, yeah. You're more familiar with the arguments you're running and you save time. I think those are the 2 most obvious benefits.
Right. And as we start closing here, do you have any strategies or just any recommendations for general practice strategies that people can do to improve their skills?
I think the two most valuable practice / prep strategies are, one, you know, spend more time thinking as opposed to researching, like I've talked about. If you have half an hour that you were thinking about blocking out for researching a tricky case, try just mulling it over instead. I'm not, you know, guaranteeing you're going to find the kill shot solvency argument that's going to win every round you get against this case. But I do think it's something that everyone should at least experiment with, even if they do decide they prefer the research approach afterwards. Second, I think practice rounds, parley rounds in particular, are valuable because they force you to generate arguments every round, and getting better at that process is worthwhile no matter what sort of TP round you might later find yourself in, whether it be, you know, AF, NEG, NEG without a brief, etc. And in particular, I'd recommend practice rounds with judges that you consider qualified or that you trust. I actually think that's, you know, the most valuable form of preparation, you know, better than coaching, better than researching, better than thinking even, is getting feedback from people that you at the very least respect, because you're not going to always, well, not always, you always will not see your own blind spots by definition. You need other people to call you out on those. And I think that's why practicing with a judge is particularly valuable. And that might seem obvious, but I think it's important to say, because my impression is that over the course of, I don't know, say the last 2 to 3 years, since COVID in particular, people have wanted to do more practice rounds. And as a consequence, less of those practice rounds have judges of some sort. You know, having a practice round with no judge is better than no practice rounds at all. But I think it's worthwhile putting in, you know, the 15, 30 minutes to secure a judge for that round, because, you know, you might be able to see how a neg team responds to a certain argument if you don't have a judge, because that performance of the neg team is going to be there no matter what. But, you know, the judge might see something that no one else in the round does, which again is very obvious, but I think it's undervalued and isn't something I'd emphasize.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise with me and this podcast today, Ben.
Yeah, of course. Thanks again for having me on. I've enjoyed this.
Me too. I appreciate it, and take care. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you have any comments, suggestions, questions, or just want to keep up to date, you can follow my Instagram at onpointpodcast_. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you in the next one.